Today is Wednesday, December the 6th, God's salvation through history. We'll pick up this evening in Joshua, the 11th chapter. Joshua, the 11th chapter, verses 1 through 15. And here we have the text of the taking of Hazor, the city Hazor. And you have to go to archaeology and a lot of outside history, secular history, to find out a little bit about the cities. And I think it's kind of important, too, because it gives a little bit more structure to the happenings that are going on. God doesn't dwell a lot on that, but it helps give them some idea as far as what is transpiring in the country that they're going into, the children of Israel, and what they're facing and the odds against it. Hazor was a great city-state it was one of the greatest of the Canaanite city-states at that time, and it was a metropolis, and it was the largest city of Canaan. And it had a population estimated around 40,000. And of course, like with all the other cities, she was well defended to defy any attacks that would come about. And Hazor was fortified with massive ramparts of beaten earth that were built up. The beaten earth was built up. It had a high, thick, heavily protected wall. And it had a deep fortification ditch that was around it. And with that ditch, of course, anybody that was getting to going to attack them, they would have to overcome these obstacles as far as the built-up earth rampart, the ditch that was there. You just couldn't run flat. You had the ditch that you had to go through. And they had all this to protect the city, and they had the means to do it. And Hazor had two areas within one city, kind of within the other. It had two separate areas within it. One was an upper city rising to a height of about 130 feet, having around 30 acres, surrounded by its own wall. And then you had the lower part that was around it that had an additional 175 acres, and it was also protected on all sides by a wall. So the city was kind of double fortified, with a higher up upper city with a wall around it, and then the lower city with a wall around it also. And it was the capital of Canaan, and it was head, according to Joshua chapter 11 and verse 10, it was head of all the surrounding kingdoms. And so Jabin was the king of Hazor at this time, and he was hearing of the victories of Israel and the cities in the southern region, according to Joshua 11 verse 1. So the noise was being sent about to other kingdoms as far as what Joshua had done already concerning the central campaign that he went through, and then in going into the northern campaign and the southern campaign, these nations had already heard what had happened and the kingdoms that were lost and what he had done. So in hearing this news and feeling the threat of Israel and what they had done, because some of the other cities that they've taken so far were well defended, and you know, with what they did to Egypt, in hearing what they had done to the Egyptian Empire, that was a great feat for them to do, because Egypt was one of the greatest dynasties at that time, and they had defeated them. And so this is noised abroad. So Jabin sent to all the kings around him on the north and the south and the west and the east to come and to support him and to fight with him against Israel, according to verses 1 through 3. And here in verse 3, you have all the previous mentioned nations that God would drive out for Israel. You had the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, and the Hivites. And all these are around Hazor. And you have not just a small little district that Joshua was fighting in, but you had a large area that was encompassed that all these battles took place over. Okay, when an enemy fled, they fled to all these other places, and the army of Israel would follow them and, you know, they would engage in battles and so forth as they were retreating or running or whatever. So it wasn't just a localized, as you would think, city that the battle was taking place in. The battle extended far and beyond just the city. It would say, like, from here to Mount Vernon to Berea, running all this area as far as chasing the enemy and the battles and so forth. And you have to bear in mind that most of it was by foot as far as the battles. So here in verse 3, you have all the nations that God had said before in the promise that he was going to remove them from the land for Israel's sake because of the sins that they did. And these are mentioned here in verse 3, and these are the ones that Jabin sent to have his help. All these nations come together, and it's described by Scripture in verse 4 that they were much people, even as the sands that is upon the seashore in multitude. So when you consider all these kingdoms coming together and their soldiers and so forth, it's just not a small army. It says the multitude of them. It was much people as the sands is upon the seashore in multitude. And also with that, they also had horses and chariots. And they had a numerous host of those. That this multitude of horses and chariots was within this vast army that had gathered to go against Israel. A lot of resources they had that Israel did not have. So Israel not only had to fight against the valiant people and the manpower, but they also had back then the technology militarily that they would have employed upon, being the horses, the chariots, and later on we'll see with the camels and so forth. So they had that to contend with that they didn't have. So it's a large mass group that is there, and we find that Joshua and his forces are up against the strongest possible political and military adversary at that time that they had been up against. All the others had not been that great. So Hazor again was a city-state, and those territories over which Hazor exercised dominion are grouped in there, and they all come together against Israel. We are told by the writer of the numerical and technological superiority of the Canaanites again, by their strength and the tools that they had. And the thing that's interesting with the taking here of Hazor is that before in the accounts of the battles, we had a detailed description of the strategies that God had laid out and that Joshua had laid out in the first three battles that were given by the writer. In this one, there is no strategy that's given ahead of time. It just records that Joshua came suddenly and fell upon them at the waters of Merom, according to verse 5. So it's outside the city, down toward the southwest, where the waters of Merom are, of Hazor. And that's where it is. It's about 8 miles southwest of Hazor. And with that, it puts Joshua in the middle of this Canaanite territory. Because Hazor was a city-state, and all these other nations, the five nations, are down, encompassing to the west, all the way to the south, over back to the east again, and the waters of Merom are south of Hazor, so it puts him in their territory. It's not on the outskirts, but he's actually within their territory, that he comes upon them suddenly, it says. God encourages Joshua, again before the battle in this, to not fear, because he says tomorrow about this time the enemy would be delivered up and Joshua would burn their chariots and hamstring their horses. So God is telling him, Joshua, don't be alarmed by the multitudes that you see. Don't be alarmed that they can run around with their horses and their strength and with their chariots and so forth, and you're just on foot. Don't be alarmed with that. Tomorrow at this time, it's going to be yours. And not only that, but you're going to burn their chariots and you're going to hamstring or cut the tendons on the horses. That's what you're going to be able to do, that you're going to have this gained victory, according to verse 6. By cutting the hamstrings, they're crippling the horse to kind of make it ineffective and powerless, and it's cutting the leg tendons. I don't know if it completely incapacitates the horse, that it can't be used for any other purpose, but it does hinder them quite significantly. with the horse on that. So Joshua is given that. Meron, the waters of Meron and the city of Meron there had narrow defiles. And with these narrow defiles and narrow paths and so forth, it was also surrounded with a rugged forest. And that would have neutralized the strength and the mobility of the Canaanite chariots. And it would have given an advantage to Joshua when he came upon them. They wouldn't have been able, it wasn't wide open, flat territory. They had narrow defiles to where it would have been difficult for them to run roughshod through there with their chariots and with their horses and with the forest and stuff. The rugged forest, you're going to have the landscape with that that would prevent that as far as if you were out in an open plain and were fighting under those circumstances. So that was a definite advantage to Joshua. He defeats the armies and he smites them that none were left remaining. And he did as God bade him to do in burning the chariots with fire and hamstringing the horses in Joshua chapter 11 verses 8 and 9. With that, after he destroys this army down at the waters of Meron, he then turns back to Hazor and destroys all within the city and burns it with fire, verses 10 and 11. So Joshua took all the cities of the other kings around there that had joined in. He took that and he kept the spoil and the cattle, and God allowed them to keep that unto themselves, verses 12 through 14. So again, God encourages Joshua. He tells Joshua, you're going to be victorious. And with this, Joshua realizes that it comes from God. That the battle and the victory through the battle comes from God. Because when you look at the vast strength and majority of the enemy, the odds are against Joshua as far as coming out. Completely against him. But God is fighting for them. He's the one that claims the victory on the battle. And so God delivers them from their enemies, just as he had promised before that these nations, these five nations, are going to be destroyed. And he's going to cast them out. If you remember, they were to be cast out because of their iniquities that they had done, mostly because of the defilement and the idolatry that they were steeped in. In chapter 11 and verse 15, you'll notice that there's a chain of command on this. And it states there, as the Lord commanded Moses, his servant, so did Moses command Joshua, and so did Joshua. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord commanded Moses. So you have where God commands Moses, when you go back to Numbers, the 33rd chapter. The 33rd chapter, verses 50 through 56. The Lord spake unto Moses in the plain of Moab by Jordan near Jericho, saying, speaking to the children of Israel, and saying to them, when you are passed over Jordan into the land of Canaan, then ye shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, and destroy all their pictures, destroy all their molten images, and quite pluck down all their high places. And ye shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land, and dwell therein, for I have given you the land to possess it. And ye shall divide the land by lot for an inheritance among your families, and to the more ye shall give the more inheritance, and the fewer ye shall give the less inheritance. Every man's inheritance shall be in the place where his lot falleth. According to the tribes of your fathers ye shall inherit. But if you will not drive out the inhabitants of the land but from before you, then it shall come to pass that those which ye let remain of them shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and shall vex you in the land wherein ye dwell. Moreover, it shall come to pass that I shall do unto you as I thought to do unto them. And we know that through time and through history that that did come about. Because they went off into apostasy, they went off into idolatry, and God displaced them, as you're going through the review on Sunday morning, that God did displace them by the Assyrians and by the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians. So it came about that they were displaced, and most of the reason why was because they adopted the idolatry of these heathen nations. And they also tried to serve God at the same time. So God instructs and commands Moses, you can see that also in Exodus, the 34th chapter, verse 10, and he said, "Behold, I make a covenant before all thy people. I will do marvels such as have not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation. And all the people among which thou art shall see the work of the Lord, for it is a terrible thing that I will do with you. Observe that thou, which I command thee this day, behold, I drive out from before you the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Take heed to yourself, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, whither thou goest, lest it be for a snare in the midst of thee. But ye shall destroy their altars, break down their images, and cut down their groves. For thou shalt worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go a-whoring after their gods, and do sacrifice unto the gods, and one call thee, and thou eat of his sacrifice. And thou take of their daughters unto thy sons, and their daughters go a-whoring after their gods, and make thy sons go a-whoring after their gods. Thou shalt make thee no molten gods." So God was explicit in his commands to Moses. And in Deuteronomy, 31st chapter, Moses lays these instructions also to Joshua. Verse 7 of chapter 31, "And Moses called unto Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel, Be strong and be of good courage, for thou must go with this people into the land which the Lord hath sworn unto their fathers to give them, and thou shalt cause them to inherit it. And the Lord, he it is that doth go before thee. He will be with thee. He will not fail thee, neither forsake thee. Fear not, neither be dismayed." Then when you look at Joshua, the first chapter, God tells Joshua, "Be strong and of a good courage," in verse 6, "For unto this people shalt thou divide for inheritance the land which I swear unto their fathers to give them. Only be thou strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest prosper whithersoever thou goest." Again, the command that was given to him was from the standpoint that they weren't to make any league with the nations, and they weren't to be in idolatry with the nations. That's why they were supposed to destroy them. And that is the command that he gave. Don't turn to the right or to the left of it. Don't be steeped into idolatry like they are. And that was the command that he was given. So in chapter 11 of Joshua, in verse 12, that's why you have the statement there recorded when he went through all the cities and the kings and destroyed and smote them with the edge of the sword, and he utterly destroyed them. He did it as Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded. So you have the God telling Moses what they were to do when they got into the promised land, Moses telling Joshua, and Joshua carrying that out in the promised land as far as destroying the people. You may look at it, it's for your further study as far as why did God utterly destroy all the people. Yes, he destroyed women, children, by the armies. All were utterly destroyed, not just the men of valor, not just the men of war. But you would have to attribute it to that God knew how steep they were in idolatry. He knew how bad the influence would be upon Israel because he had warned them. And that's why he was having them be removed. It isn't that God wasn't compassionate or that God is without mercy, but it's because God knew the influence that would happen, and that if you don't put a stop to the influence that would happen, then you would be faced with possibly a situation like you had before the flood, when all of mankind had evil imaginations and evil thoughts. Yes.
Why were the cities built on a mound, not destroyed?
Why were they
not destroyed?
A lot of them were burnt with fire. Jericho was burnt with fire. Hazor was burnt with fire. They were burnt with fire. And then also with Jericho, was it Jericho or Ai, that there was a curse that was placed, that Joshua placed with it, that if it was to be rebuilt, the time frame and some of the things that would happen with it. So they were, as far as they were burnt to the ground, I don't know if that helps.
I know Hazar was, it said, and the others were left. They weren't burnt. Everyone was exterminated. But, you know, God had promised them that they were going to be dwelling in cities that they had built, cisterns they had. That was going to be some of the things that they received from Him.
Yeah, good thought. Anything else on that?
That was Jericho that the curse was on.
As far as Jericho with the curse on the building with the lay something with the firstborn.
I forgot how it went. And something happened that when the walls was started would be the death of the firstborn, and when they ended, the death of something else. I forgot how it was. At the beginning, at the end.
Mostly you have to bear in mind that the first battle, God required the first of the spoil, and that was God's. And I think that's significant from the standpoint that God always required, even with them leaving from Egypt, if I'm not mistaken, He required the firstborn, because He took the firstborn. And so they could, trying to think of the term,
redeem? What are you talking
they
about?
They could redeem. They could redeem the firstborn with money on that, with so much. The firstborn, they could redeem it of, I believe it was people and so forth. But
the animals they had to.
The animals they had
the
to.
The clean animal they had to, well, to kill them. But they could eat the clean animal with the other one, the unclean they could.
Right. And the people they could redeem with the money to go into the sanctuary. But since God destroyed the firstborn, He claimed the firstborn for Him. With going in